A few years ago, I was traveling on a trip not unlike this one. I was traveling to preach in a congregation not my own in the state of Iowa. And I spent the night at a Best Western hotel. It was during the Iowa State Fair, and I think I had the last hotel room in the county. That Best Western was adjacent to a cornfield. And the thing is, I have always liked to do a run-through of my sermons before taking the pulpit. And in a hotel room, that is very challenging. Like your ministers, Sean and Gretchen, I believe so deeply in witnessing to the good news of this faith. And yet something tells me that there is no message, however saving, that is likely to be welcome from an adjacent hotel room at 7:30 a.m. So I found myself at the far edge of the hotel parking lot, standing on a narrow strip of green lawn that was facing tall late summer corn. If you've ever stood adjacent to a cornfield, I invite you to call up that feeling. It is humid, it is buggy, my hair was growing frizzy, and my shoes were getting damp, and even so, I inflected and gestured and finished my sermon, and finally, satisfied, I turned around. And then I almost tripped, and then I almost cried, because not 2 feet behind me, there was then a lawn chair. In it was a man. He was maybe in his 70s, and he was wearing a plaid shirt and chinos and a John Deere ball cap and the biggest smile. We stared at each other. I was speechless with embarrassment. And then he leaned forward and said, "I reckon you persuaded that corn to stand upright." I ran away. And I filed that moment under random embarrassing things that happened to me during seminary, sort of a long list. The time I preached an entire sermon to a field of grain with my back turned unwittingly to my actual audience. And I will tell you that this is what I remembered somehow as I began to think more deeply about perfectionism, about that uniquely American fear of being not enough that can make it so hard to be present to the truth of what is. If you have ever tried to play an instrument, learn a language, or throw a baseball farther, you have probably been told that practice makes perfect. Best-selling social science writer Malcolm Gladwell explained in his book Outliers that it takes 10,000 hours of targeted practice to perfect a skill set. He also argued that more often than not, it is this extra level of practice beginning from a very young age that holds the key to expert level mastery. He argued this, and then the idea that there must be something that we could do, or something in the case of would-be parents of star athletes, something you can buy that will lead to success. It has captivated upper middle class America. People have taken to calling this the 10,000 hour rule. In less than a decade, it took on force of law. And the idea isn't simply to practice. As motivational speaker Vince Lombardi used to say, practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. Thus, kids for half a generation have been encouraged to get in the game early, to specialize, to forego other sports or even family, perhaps church activities, for the sake of soccer, or ballet, or even academics. And a team of sports psychologists recently asserted that our collective internalization of the 10,000-hour rule has contributed massively to the harder, faster, earlier mentality of so much of our parenting culture. And the cost is play. Our kindergartners, they can't play in what used to be sandboxes and sewing kits because they are busy at desks learning to read a full year sooner than children a generation ago. Our older kids can no longer play for love of the game because skill development is no longer a pickup game in a field or a backyard, but targeted practice. And the thing is, the goal of these strategies is not mastery across the board. This isn't trying to make all of us champion soccer players. Instead, in an idea that harkens back to our religious past, it's a bit like the Puritans in Massachusetts. The goal in their congregations was to provide the conditions so that the chosen few could rise out of the many. This was never about the 99% of kids who won't compete at an elite level. This theology is about the 1% who might, and hooking consumer style, all of our hopes along with it. But is this working? Is the 10,000-hour rule really what anybody wants? And is it possible to set aside the realities of our bodies, even for a moment, and create perfection? Maybe not. It turns out that the 10,000-hour rule was based on a single study of musicians. The author of that study has since disclaimed Gladwell's conclusions and nearly everything they have been used for. Subsequent studies indicate, go figure, that different activities require different investments of time for proficiency. And so do different people. And the larger truth that I invite us to hold is that it actually doesn't matter if the 10,000-hour rule is correct, because for the vast majority of us, and we forgot to have this conversation, neither perfect practice nor the elite outcomes it is aiming for fit our lives, our needs, our goals. And so that line from the book of Mark, people were not made for the Sabbath. It was created for the people. It's an invitation to hold the truth that the point of a gift perhaps was never rule mongering, but rest, joy, connection with what gives our lives meaning. We do need space to learn. I want to be clear that I am not anti-practice. Practicing is part of what allows us to do the critical work, including in this political moment, to make mistakes and then reflect and improve. Practicing is vitally important for skill development, and we cherish the musicians and poets and athletes among us. But I want you to know this, that practicing for perfection, it doesn't make perfect. It makes pathology. And in fact, a significant and growing body of educational and psychological research suggests that a perfection orientation can actually damage our ability to connect with one another. It dampens our impulses toward creativity. It can stifle our ability to learn before we ever learn to read. Psychologist Carol Dweck is a researcher at Stanford University, and she spent 2.5 decades studying what she has come to call growth mindset. It turns out that there is actually a spectrum with growth mindset on one side and something that she calls fixed mindset on the other. An orientation toward one side or the other often manifests from very early childhood. So I invite you to think about you and other people you know. Like a muscle, this way of being or this one in the world, it becomes strong with repeated use, with practice. The hallmarks of a growth mindset are embracing challenges rather than avoiding them, persisting in the face of obstacles, believing, it's a mindset, that effort, that some good old-fashioned elbow grease, as my dad used to say, is a path to mastery. It believes in learning from criticism. And finally, growth mindset finds encouragement in the successes of others, taking those as good news for all of our future. In a growth mindset, success is never a zero-sum game, but a level of mastery to which we can inspire one another and our communities. On the other side of the spectrum, in the fixed mindset, every moment becomes a test of your innate talent. It's a watermark of whether or not you are good enough to cut it. If this is our mental model, failure is not a chance to grow, but a revelation of our immutable, shameful inadequacy. And growth mindset isn't just about our relationship with ourselves. It profoundly changes how we relate to our communities. Because one thing that researchers have observed is that the fixed mindset model calls us to feel ashamed of those who mess up and threatened by those who succeed. Think about that. Other people's successes and also their failures, they threaten to expose my own weaknesses. Success in others makes me look badly in comparison. And their failure evokes my deepest fear that I too might be inadequate. This manifests clearly in both children and adults. Children in one experiment, since replicated, completed an easy puzzle, something they were all able to do. And afterward, they were offered individually a single line of praise. Either "you worked hard to solve that," or "I can tell that you are especially smart." Then these children were given a hard puzzle, one that they had basically zero chance of being able to solve. The kids who were praised for their smarts requested an easier task versus the challenging one when asked what they would like to do next. They persisted for less time in the face of frustration, and they visibly, miserably sweated through the test. And then, and this is the part I find most concerning for our work together, those children returned to the same easy puzzle, something they had already completed with success. Their achievement fell by 20%, going back to what they already knew. The kids' praise for their work, on the other hand, not for perfection, for doing the work just to hang in, they asked for a harder challenge. They visibly enjoyed playing with it, even though they too failed. And when they returned to that challenge at their own grade level, they improved their time and performance by 30%. Encouraging growth mindset. I will tell you, this applies to adults too. 2 summers ago, the New York Times released an online puzzle challenge that was also a secret psychological study of American perfectionist culture. It had a very simple goal. You were to deduce the rule behind the making of a four-digit number. It proceeded according to rules. And respondents in the instructions, which were simple, were instructed to take their time and be sure that they had figured out the answer before submitting one time the response in the text box. There was a place to practice and try. The game provided immediate feedback to explorations of the rules, such that it was possible in four attempts for anyone to know what the rule was, for sure. But you had to be willing to hear no, to get the problem wrong at least twice to do it. More than three quarters of American respondents made no learning attempts at all. They simply entered a number preferring to guess and why, rather than hear the word no. It is hard, even for adults, to put looking good on the line for the sake of discovery, even when the only audience is ourselves. This choice is often unexamined, automatic, but it doesn't have to be. Researchers have found that growth mindset, it creates a passion for learning rather than a hunger for approval, and that it can be cultivated through deliberate practice. The end result is people who are not only not discouraged by failure, but who actually don't see themselves as failing when they take a risk to grow, because they see themselves as learning. So how does this relate to our work as Unitarian Universalists? How does it relate to your work here at Foothills? For starters, we need to know that it matters tremendously in our communities how we see and respond to learning behaviors among us. Put another way, to things that look a lot like failing. Are questions encouraged here? Do we give room and rein in our models for people to try things themselves? And is there a reflective coaching process as learning opportunities happen? I'm talking about church, but you can put this in place in any area of your life. And these are important questions for us in this moment for progressive faith, because perfectionism can be collective. And if we are collectively unwilling to fail, we are also going to be collectively unwilling to try. And that's not just true here within your walls. We have so much important work to do in our wider communities, and the stakes are very high. Sometimes, as you may have discovered these past few years, engaging with things like immigration and Black Lives Matter, we are called to begin while we are still familiarizing ourselves with the rules and the culture and the vocabulary. We have to continue that work to get up to speed. But we have to be willing to move, not knowing all of the answers, even in the process. I invite you to think back to the children working on the puzzle, the ones told, "You must be smart," rather than, "You must have worked hard." And wonder with me, what is it as a people of progressive faith? Which of those messages is it that we tell ourselves in our deepest denominational identity? How do we talk with each other when we gather? What is our Unitarian Universalist equivalent of, "You must be especially smart"? What keeps us frozen? What invites us to jump over a low bar rather than entering together in community into a continuous learning process? We so desperately want to be good at this work. And our siblings of color, those with whom we want to be in solidarity on the side of love, have some things to say about this. Because declining to act until we have it all figured out is a position of privilege, y'all. The truth is that we must engage, and that challenging things like structural racism, family separation, the conditions rooted in the policies of our country that make it so that people must come across our borders for a future for their children, that is not the job of people of color exclusively. It is all of our job, and it is going to take all of us. And in the words of T. Denise Anderson, Reverend in the Methodist tradition, who has some words to say to white people who would be in solidarity: at this point, my friends, I am not interested in your listening. For I think the danger in this listening posture, while it feels to you like a mindful and conscientious thing to do, is that it is far too convenient. It is a great way, for the sake of finding the right action, to take no action instead. We are the most connected and information overloaded that human beings have ever been. You can transmit entire books to your handheld devices in seconds. White allies, please report for duty. This is your shift. And we are trying. There was a large, love-filled rally here in Fort Collins a few days ago. Wave your hand at me if you were there. Thank you. Thank you for the work that you are doing, and know that it matters. Each move forward together matters. You are listening in your community, and we are all denomination-wide continuing to learn together, and it is hard and it is exciting. We are in the midst of a shared adventure to become not simply the people of our heritage and legacy, but the people who will build a different world together. And along the way to that world, we are going to mess up. We are. Possibly every day. Which means we have to know how to lean into failure and trust that we are going to come out the other side knowing something deeper as a we. And this is a reason why, as a minister, I love improvisational theater. Do we have anyone here who is into improv? Okay, well, you're all going to be into improv in just a second. There are three rules that are often offered to people who are beginning the study of improv, and I find all three of them deeply relevant for congregational life and for our work in the world. The first is say yes wherever you can. We often frame that as accept the invitation. People who are new to improv often assume when they're in a scene and someone says, "Welcome to my pizza party," that the way to make the scene interesting is to say, "No, what are you talking about? We're on the moon." And we do that sort of thing trying to work with each other in building the new world. We are offered a vision and we say immediately, "No, this other thing," instead of saying yes and. Rule number one, accept the invitation. Rule number two, make your scene partners look good. Who here in this place are your scene partners? This is not a rhetorical question. I invite you to actually look at them. Who are your scene partners? Point, gesture, yes, we are each other's scene partners all of the time, and that is true in our wider movements, and it can be true across broad coalitions. We are going to call each other in And we are going to call each other forward, asking always, how can we be more beautiful together? Make your scene partners look good. And our final rule, and my favorite, though it is hard, I invite you to find the same hands that you use to say, I am here now and claim your space. And I invite you to make what I call the gentle fist of failure. Can you all do this? Okay. So I invite you to be ready, and then we're going to raise them in the air, and we are going to say, I failed. I failed. We're going to do that again, and I invite you to do it joyfully. You ready? I failed. Yes. I tell you, my people, these are words and a spirit we need. We are not going to stay in this moment, but we are going to celebrate it and notice it when it comes, because it is what allows us to pull ourselves and each other forward. And because the truth is we have all failed some these past months, perhaps these past few hours. We have failed personally, we have failed professionally, we have failed relationally. And yet we are called, even in that truth, to stay engaged, and that means failing more. Failing forward and then learning to say one to another, we worked hard on that. And here is where we're going next. In the spirit of that going, you are invited, and details are in your order of service. As Sean mentioned at the beginning of the service, you're invited to join in the work of the food pantry that you as a congregation support. They need more hands and more help this afternoon. If you are available to bring yourselves and your commitment to that place, know that you are furthering the work of love. And stay tuned for further invitations as we continue to mobilize and rally and lift our voices in love around immigration as a human rights issue. Thank you for the work that you are doing. Friends, we form new communities in our movement and in our world with each passing year. Communities of passion and mission. Communities that must have a sense of safety in experimenting with one another. Communities that do not have time to give our words to empty cornfields. There are so many who are hungry for our engagement, including possibly that man who was behind me on the grass, my lawn chair congregation of one. There are things that I could have asked him and ways that we could have connected, but none of them occurred to me. I was too busy being embarrassed that someone heard my imperfect practice run. I failed. But in the larger picture, there is good news. There is still time. There is always this moment. Who is waiting for your imperfect work? The corn can grow without our help, so let us not turn our backs on our listeners, on our communities, on the good gift we have in one another. We have work to do. Joyfully and imperfectly. Amen.